Welcome to ID the Future from Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. In this fourth and final segment, Nate Herbst of the God Solution and Casey Luskin discuss intelligent design research at the Biologic Institute. Luskin also notes that professors lack academic freedom to discuss intelligent design at public institutions. He highlights the case of a physics professor from Ball State University.
Can you tell us, do intelligent design theorists do research, and what does some of that research actually look like?
That's a great question, and the answer to that question is yes, despite what you might read among some critics on the internet, who sort of, facts to them don't matter, they're going to have their little lines and their objections to ID, and the facts really are irrelevant to whether their objections are valid. ID proponents do research. One of the major hubs of ID research is funded by Discovery Institute. It's called Biologic Institute. It's a research lab based here in Seattle, and some of the research that they are doing is testing the co-option model of the evolution of new proteins. And so if you mentioned Michael Behe earlier, if you go back to Michael Behe's first big book, Darwin's Black Box, he argued that there are many structures in cells that require all of their parts to function or they don't work. And these kinds of what he called irreducibly complex structures cannot evolve in the step-by-step manner required by Darwinian evolution, because either all their parts are there and they work, or they're missing a part and they don't work. So they have to have everything present. They can't evolve in a stepwise manner. The typical response from the evolutionary camp was, well, maybe we can evolve these irreducibly complex structures by co-opting or borrowing other parts of the cell, suddenly retooling them so that they can all come together spontaneously to form this complex molecular machine. Well, I always found these co-option speculations from evolutionists to be very non-compelling. I found them to be implausible and, frankly, unlikely to occur without some kind of intelligent guidance. But that's fine. We can actually test their model by asking, what does it take to take a protein and then retool that protein to do a new job in the cell? And that is the question that biologic researchers are experimentally testing. What they're doing, they took a family of proteins that has very closely related proteins, they have very similar sequences, but they perform different roles in the cell. And so what they try to do is they try to induce mutations into those proteins to see if they could basically convert protein A to function like protein B. And they wanted to ask how many mutations would it take to change the function of a protein to that of a very closely related protein. This is the kind of evolutionary conversion that evolutionary biologists will say is very easy to accomplish. And it's happened all the time in the history of life that a protein could adopt a new function of a very closely related protein. Okay, fine. What does it take to do that? Well, the biologic research is showing that basically it would require more mutations to cause one of these evolutionary conversions to occur than would be likely to arrive in the entire history of the Earth. So basically, the plausibility of these co-option scenarios is very, very low, because to convert a protein to change its function to a very similar protein's function would require more mutations than could arise given the entire history of the Earth. So co-option models basically are not plausible in light of this research, and it's really good empirical research. If you're interested, you can read the papers in the journal's website that they are publishing. It's bio-complexity.org.
Bio-complexity.org. And I think it was Dembski, right, that came up with the concept of the universal probability bound, and how these things that don't line up with that are statistically, literally impossible. They could not possibly have happened.
That's exactly right. That's exactly the way this argument works, is that there are so many mutations required, even for a very simple evolutionary conversion, that it would be below the bound of things that are feasible to happen in the entire history of the universe.
He generously set that, I think, at 10 to the 200th. And I mean, some of the statistics, like the linking up of just the right-handed versions of the amino acids and nucleotides for the simplest theoretical organism, would be something like 1 in 10 to the 37,000th power. So, I mean, orders of magnitude beyond the universal probability bound. So when we see these unrealistic statistics, I was actually debating an atheist once here on campus on Darwin's, I forget which birthday, we had an evolution slash creation debate. And I mentioned these statistics to him, and he just said, who cares? It happened, so I don't care about the statistics. And that's what we see with the traditional naturalistic evolutionary perspective. Don't tell me about the statistics. Don't mention the facts. We're here, and so again, it's the only game in town evolution happened, you know? Is that correct?
You definitely see that quite a bit, and you put it very well. That's the epitome of the naturalistic mindset. We are going to assume that naturalism is true. We're not actually going to be open-minded to the possibility that it's not true. And so we're just going to say, look, even if I have no idea how it happened and it seems totally impossible under normal rules of scientific analysis, I'm still going to believe it. People are welcome to believe that if they want, but let's just be honest about what that is. That's faith. It's actually blind faith. It's believing something where you have no evidence. In fact, the evidence goes against it. And look, it's a free country. We still have religious freedom in a couple states these days. So if you want to have blind faith, you're welcome to have blind faith, but let's just not pretend that what you're doing is either scientific or intellectually compelling, because it's neither of those two things. Unfortunately, what you just described, that kind of mindset, is actually holding science back.
Well, Dawkins himself, famous evolutionist and atheist, often calls this very statistical enigma for him, not for the intelligent design theorist, but he would call it a stroke of luck, I think betraying the reality of what it is.
So do scientists have academic freedom to support intelligent design?
That's a good question, and it depends on where those scientists are. I would say in most public state universities today, in biology departments, scientists do not have freedom to support intelligent design. I know many people who are ID proponents in those situations, basically untenured faculty at public universities, state university biology departments, and they are scared to death of the world finding out that they support intelligent design. So they keep their heads down and they do not talk about their views. They have been muzzled. Sometimes when scientists speak out about intelligent design, they get put back down. There was a professor a couple of years ago at Ball State University in Indiana. He's a physicist. And essentially what happened was he taught a senior interdisciplinary class that dealt with science and society. And this class was approved by the university. Everything he did was fully approved by the university. And he looked at sort of the bigger questions in physics, looking at the fine-tuning of the universe for life. And what does that mean? The vast majority of the class, simply looking at the evidence from science for the Big Bang, for fine-tuning of the universe, it was just strictly looking at the science. And then at the very end of the class, he investigated some of the different perspectives that are out there to explain this fine-tuning, and one of those perspectives was intelligent design. Well, Jerry Coyne, the well-known atheist evolution blogger on the Internet, he's also an evolutionary biologist at the University of Chicago. He found out about this class at Ball State University, and he then got the Freedom From Religion Foundation to send a nasty lawyer letter to the university saying, if you don't shut this professor down, we're going to sue you guys. So guess what the university did? Not only did they shut the professor down, they actually enacted a speech code at Ball State University which said that professors are not allowed to support intelligent design in their classes. And so this is what's literally going on some of our university campuses right now, is the evolutionists are so afraid of having a discussion that they are enacting speech codes to prevent intelligent design from being supported in the classroom. This is really dangerous to some of the foundational freedoms of our society, when professors are not free to talk about their views, even controversial ones. I mean, if you don't have academic freedom to talk about a minority controversial view, then academic freedom means nothing. Because you always have academic freedom to talk about a majority view that everybody agrees with. Academic freedom is only tested when somebody expresses a minority view. But this professor was not using his class to proselytize. He was not using it to promote religion. He was using it to talk about different legitimate scientific and philosophical views out there. But intelligent design was not allowed. So unfortunately, this is not an anomaly. We've seen a number of cases like this over the years. And I would say that in many places, the answer to your question definitely is no. Scientists do not have academic freedom to talk about intelligent design.
We've always heard about the attack of religion on science and how historically, and most people are referring to the Catholic Church several hundred years ago, how the church opposed science and went against science. It looks like now we're seeing the exact opposite, right? We're seeing the evolutionary battle on science and debate. It's frustrating to say the least. Well, it's been a great show. Any last thoughts?
No, I really appreciate what you guys are doing. And I know that you guys get broadcasted in sort of a college campus, college town environment. And I would just encourage students who are interested in this issue to keep an open mind and make sure that they do what they can to investigate this topic for themselves. You know, certainly take courses in evolution, understand the evolutionary viewpoint, but don't stop there. Go out and proactively investigate views that are maybe not being talked about in your classes and learn about those views, like intelligent design, from the proponents. I mean, read what the critics had to say as well, but make sure you read what the proponents are saying, or you really want to understand the argument.
That was Casey Luskin with Nate Herbst. Stay tuned for more episodes at ID the Future, and thank you for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2015. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.